The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention, for the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Good morning. Please be seated.
Morning.
Welcome to the Fourth Circuit. We look forward to counsel's presentations. Judge Hamilton and I, of course, are absolutely delighted to welcome to the bench and to be joining our newest colleague, Judge Henry Floyd. We'll proceed now to the first case, number 10-1484, Ortec International, Inc. versus Trans-Pacific Tire and Wheel, Inc. Mr. Kotzer, we'll be glad to hear from you, sir.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is John Kotzker, and I represent the appellants in this case. We're here this morning on an appeal that arose out of two consolidated cases out of the United States District Court for the District of Maryland. The cases involved the contractual and business relationships between the appellee and the appellants. The cases were centered around the issues involving the importation and exclusive distribution of tires manufactured in China, as well as several other agreements and courses of dealings between the parties, which will be discussed a little bit later in this argument. We're here on four issues, and they are in a nutshell. Did the trial court properly find that the term, quote, entire production, unquote, was not sufficient to be considered a quantity term under the UCC? Secondly, does the fact that an officer of Ortec who testified that all the details of an agreement were not reached preclude a finding for detrimental reliance, or as it's known in Maryland, otherwise known as promissory estoppel? Thirdly, under Federal Rule Civil Procedure 62, should the district court have provided a forum to determine if the purchase of a supersedious bond would have caused harm, and should this court adopt the Fifth Circuit's rule on that issue? And finally, under the UCC, did Ortec International act reasonably in selling the nonconforming goods, specifically the tires, in this case? Under the first issue, the record reflects that an officer of Ortec emailed its intention of ordering the entire production from the Chinese manufacturer. The district court did not find that the emails confirmed a quantity and that, therefore, the writings did not establish a contractual relationship. The issue is that the district court and the appellee seemed to focus on was that the email was transmitted to the appellant's agent in China, and therefore, the district court did not find that there was any reason to believe that this was communicated to the appellee. But we believe very strongly that that is a question as to the weight of the evidence and should have been treated as such.
Wasn't the issue is whether or not there was sufficient basis to meet the statute of frauds?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The question was whether or not what you're saying satisfied the statute of frauds in Maryland.
Well, that is correct, and we're dealing with the situation.
Well, tell me how you think it did.
Well, the relationship between the parties was such that under the UCC, there is a way that writings can be considered and can provide the basis for an agreement. And under 2201 of the UCC and under the Maryland Code, which corresponds to the UCC, a series of writings between merchants can evidence the existence of a contract as long as three things are present, and that is that it's a contract for goods, that it's signed, and that it must specify a quantity. The district court focused on the quantity part of that three-prong understanding.
What about the signing part of that?
The court never addressed that. The court didn't even reach that and wouldn't focus on that because it only looked at, to my understanding, only looked at the issue that the term entire production does not qualify as a quantity term. And we believe that the case law is fairly clear, certainly in other circuits, that it is certainly a definite enough term under the UCC to qualify as a quantity term. And so our position is that the entire production term does qualify under the UCC and the case law under that issue.
Well, what about the China Company's reservation of a right to define a Canadian distributor? Doesn't that doesn't allow the company to get the entire output, does it?
Well, I think it does for the United States. I believe that that email actually, and that statement, actually supports the appellant's position that, number one, there was an exclusive contract in the United States for the entire production that would go towards the United States. And secondly, in that email, there is no contradiction that there was an agreement. In fact, it's just a clarification that you're going to be receiving. Our position is that it's you're going to be receiving the entire production for the United States, and that we're going to be using different brands for different regions around the world. The other issue is that the appellant relied upon the appellee's promise to split the costs and expenses in connection with what we refer to as the Maryland Warehouse Agreement and has become between the parties known as the Maryland Warehouse Agreement. The issue was that the parties had agreed that the appellants would obtain a warehouse in Maryland that would act as a storage facility for the appellee's tires. The appellants did, in fact, go out and obtain a location, a warehouse in Maryland, for the storage of these tires. And the appellees, the record reflects, did not contribute its share of costs and expenses as they promised that they would. The district court focused instead on the lack of definite terms with respect to the Maryland Warehouse Agreement. And it's our contention and strong belief that the court instead should have focused on whether Trans-Pacific should have known that their statements would induce Ortec to go out and obtain the warehouse. The idea that if it's not a definite agreement, that somehow the party is not entitled to seek relief under promissory estoppel does not make sense, because that is the whole point of promissory estoppel, in that it provides a mode of relief for a party that has been hurt and has no other way of seeking relief. And since the court did end up finding in favor of the appellee on the breach of contract grounds, that would seem to go further to support the contention that they should have been allowed to assert the promissory estoppel argument, and that the fact that there wasn't strong enough details in the agreement doesn't seem to hold water.
Well, do I understand your argument to be that in every and any case in which a contract formation fails, that a promissory estoppel claim is cognizable as a matter of law?
Certainly not.
Okay. Well, what am I missing in your presentation? Because that's the way it sounds.
Okay, and I apologize if I was leading the court down that road. That's certainly not my view and not our position. Our position is that if the elements of promissory estoppel are met, or detrimental reliance are met in a case, then the court should look at whether or not there was a promise that was definite enough and that dealt, that reasonably would have induced action on the part of the promisee. And then the next step would be for the court to determine whether or not that reasonable reliance actually resulted in harm to the promisee. So in our position, we believe very strongly that the court, in fact, the court didn't go there because the court stopped at the point of looking at whether or not there was a definite, at whether there was a promise that was certain enough, and we believe that determination was incorrect. The appellant, not on the Maryland warehouse issue, the appellant relied to its detriment on the promise that the appellees would go out and share the costs and expenses of the warehouse. And they, the appellees, in fact, did not do that. In our third issue on appeal, we would strongly encourage this court to adopt the Fifth Circuit's rule regarding the interpretation of Federal Rule Civil Procedure 62, which provides for the waiver or the determination of the waiver for filing a supersedious bond.
Go ahead, Judge.
Is that question not now moot?
Judge, I think that's a very interesting question. The appellant feels very strongly that there is a catch-22 provided by this rule.
But why, if it's moot, there's no reason for us to go where you want us to go.
Okay. I don't believe it is moot, Your Honor. I believe that the rule, the way it's set up, if an appeal is taken from a determination that a supersedious bond cannot be waived, the party is left in a situation where they have really one of, my understanding is, one of two tracks to take. One is to seek relief under Rule 8 of the appellate procedures, which my client did not do, or to seek an appeal of the decision under Rule 62. If a party is to take action under Rule 8 after having a decision against them under Rule 62, it could be argued that they're now in a vicious circle where they've set themselves up for the same argument that there's a mootness issue. And if, in fact, they don't take the Rule 8 option and they just use their rights to appeal under Rule 62, then whenever they get to the appellate stage, the argument could be made that there's a moot issue. So we acknowledge that there is the perception of mootness. I understand that. I would argue, however, that there's no other appropriate relief for a party who believes they've been denied the rights provided under Rule 62.
Well, you wouldn't be in the dilemma that you described had you sought to stay under Rule 8, would you?
I believe that you'd be set up for the same arguments that there's a potential mootness trap there as well. And I believe that if there's a faulty decision under Rule 62, that the parties have to be allowed their rights under the Constitution to appeal that decision and to have a proper hearing on that. We believe that in this case, there's certainly enough of an argument to be made that this court should seriously consider adopting the decision or the rule of the Fifth Circuit that was...
How would that help you if we were to do that in this case?
Well, in this case, if this court was to deny our appeal on all other grounds, I would agree that certainly there would be an issue there with mootness, and this court would then be confronted with the question of whether the Rule 62 decision in the Fifth Circuit is of such great importance that it needs to be addressed anyway. But I do acknowledge that it does present a quandary.
So if I understood your answer, you seem to be saying if you lose on all the other issues, then the bond issue is indeed moot.
I think there's certainly an argument to be made there, Your Honor. And
is there an argument to be made, or is it the fact that the bond issue would be moot?
I don't believe that it is moot. I believe that the rights...
It cannot be moot if you lose on every other issue.
Okay.
Then we have a final judgment in favor of appellees affirmed by this court.
I would agree that
okay.
It's a very strong argument.
So let's assume that you were to prevail on one or the other issues, the case goes back, then the effect would be to vacate the judgment, right?
I believe that's correct.
So either way, isn't the bond issue moot?
It is certainly a very strong case to be made that it can be considered that. However, we believe that this circuit should strongly consider adopting the Fifth Circuit's decision, because what the Fifth Circuit's decision allows for, or actually requires when there's a request for a waiver of a supersedious bond, is that there's two factors that need to be considered. The first is that if there's a showing that the party seeking relief from filing a supersedious bond can show that they have substantial assets and that they would be in the same solvency state that they're in at the present time, then there could be a waiver of the bond. Or secondly, if they can show that filing or the purchase of a bond would cause undue hardship, financial hardship on the party, then the court can use its discretion in making that determination as well.
Thank you, Mr. Kotzker. You've reserved some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Farr, we'll be glad to hear from you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Again, my name is Alec Farr, and I will be arguing on behalf of all the appellees. Your Honors, all aspects of the district court's judgments in the two cases should be affirmed. In the Trans-Pacific versus Ortec case, the district court correctly entered judgment against Ortec for damages arising from Ortec's breach of contract and its conversion of Trans-Pacific's property. And in the Ortec versus Trans-Pacific et al. Case, the district court properly disposed of each and every one of Ortec's claims, and there's no basis for disturbing any of these judgments on appeal. I'm going to start with the statute of frauds issue in the Ortec versus Trans-Pacific case. In that case, the centerpiece of Ortec's claims was that the defendant, appellee GITI China, gave Ortec an exclusive right, allegedly, to distribute the entire factory output of its Kaiwan and Primewell brand truck tires in the U.S. unconditionally, in perpetuity, with no definite terms with respect to sales quotas or performance milestones or anything else, or any other conditions under which the contract could be terminated. Ortec admitted that this highly improbable, if you will, contract was made orally on the basis of a handshake and was never reduced to writing. And it also claimed that somehow this contract was enforceable against Trans-Pacific and GITI USA, which were entities that didn't even exist at that time in 2001. Judge Chasnow, of course, found that Ortec's claims failed because it failed to satisfy the statute of frauds. And on appeal, Ortec rests its whole argument on a single email written by a GITI executive named Y.C. Chong on November 13, 2001. Now, I heard Mr. Kotzker, in response to a question from Judge Hamilton, speak in terms of an email from Mr. Veen that he sent to a third party, Sunny Zhang, which does say Ortec will take the entire factory output of the factory. However, as Judge Hamilton asked, what about the signing part? Well, that email from Mr. Veen to a third party, which wasn't even to any of the defendants, that can't satisfy the statute of frauds because it wasn't signed by any of the defendants. The only email that they focused on below and that they focused on here that's an email from one of the defendants is a response by Mr. Chong to Mr. Veen, even though it wasn't originally addressed to him. And in that email, Mr. Chong took issue with what Mr. Veen said. It simply does not establish a contract under the statute of frauds for at least three independent reasons, each of which is fatal to Ortec's claims. First, Mr. Chong's email, which is the only email the court can focus on because it's the only one that's signed, does not establish the existence of the contract. If you recall, Mr. Chong simply says, it's good that we discuss some major issues in Las Vegas where they met. It doesn't say that there was an agreement. Obviously, businessmen can discuss major issues without coming to an agreement. It also does not verify any of Mr. Veen's statements that they would take the entire factory output. So the contract that Ortec is claiming simply wasn't established by that email. Secondly, it doesn't specify the quantity of goods sold. Obviously, that's one of the critical issues in a statute of frauds analysis. Mr. Veen's email says we'll take the entire factory output. Mr. Chong's email doesn't confirm that, and in fact, it says, please note, there's an error in your email. We're going to sell to someone else in Canada. Obviously, at that point, Mr. Veen knew that he was not getting the full factory output. full factory output, to the extent it's a quantity term, has to mean full factory output. I heard Mr. Kotzker say, well, it's the full factory output that's targeted for the United States, but that's not in our email. That's not signed by us. That's too vague. That can't satisfy the statute of frauds. And then finally, this email from Mr. Chong only refers to the Kaiwan brand tire. It doesn't refer to the Primewell tire at all. And that's significant, Your Honors, because all of Ortec's claims for damages in this case relate to the Primewell tire. The evidence is undisputed that the Kaiwan tire was phased out shortly after this exchange of emails. All their claims for damages, all their claims that there was any kind of breach, are based on the Primewell tire. So for those three reasons, each of which is sufficient standing alone, they can't satisfy the statute of frauds. And also, incidentally, there's no writing to evidence any agreement by the two appellees, Trans-Pacific or GITI USA. Ortec suggests in its brief that GITI China was later replaced or subsumed by Trans-Pacific and that the contract was ratified or honored by them. Quite apart from whether the record shows that, and we don't believe it does, there's no ratification exception to the statute of frauds. Contract to meet the statute of frauds, there would have to be a signed writing by those two entities, and there isn't one. And there's no mention of GITI USA anywhere in their brief. Evidently, they've abandoned their claims with respect to them. So
talk about their contention that they rejected the non-conforming goods under the perfect tender rule.
Certainly. That goes, Your Honor, to the court's entry of summary judgment in favor of my client, Trans-Pacific, for Ortec's conversion of Trans-Pacific's property. If you recall the facts, the undisputed evidence is that there were tires that had been shipped by Trans-Pacific to this warehouse in Maryland, and that Ortec was storing them and could sell them on a consignment basis. At some point in 2004 or 2005, Ortec admittedly sold all of these tires at fire sale prices and did not and still refuses to pay for those tires. Ortec raised in response to our conversion claim the notion of perfect tender. They argued that somehow there was a contract that Trans-Pacific would only ship an appropriate mix of steer and drive tires, of these kind of truck tires, and that Ortec was proper in rejecting that and then selling it when we somehow abandoned them. There was no evidence of that at all. There was no evidence of any kind of agreement that we were required to sell an appropriate mix. In fact, the record below showed that there was no such agreement. Mr. Veen testified that the agreement with respect, Mr. Veen is Ortec's principal, testified in his 30B6 deposition that there was never any final agreement with respect to the Maryland warehouse, that it was a work in process, that all the terms were not finalized, that there were many open issues. Those were his words. So there was no final agreement, period. He also testified specifically, when I asked him in his deposition, that he couldn't remember any limits on what Trans-Pacific could ship to the warehouse. And so did Bruce Campbell, who was an employee for both of those companies. He testified there were no limits, to his knowledge, on what Trans-Pacific could ship to the warehouse. So there simply was no contract. For perfect tender under the UCC, you have to have two things. You have to have a contract that the goods don't conform to, and you have to have a clear and unequivocal rejection of the goods. Neither of those were present based on this record. That's what Judge Chasnow found. There was no agreement as to this appropriate mix that Ortec alleges that they could not conform to, so the perfect tender defense failed on that basis. And also, there was no evidence that Ortec clearly and unambiguously rejected those goods. There was testimony by Mr. Veen. The best he could do is say, well, I called them up and I complained them about them all the time. Well, the mere complaint about the quality of the goods isn't a clear and unequivocal rejection under the UCC, and we cited some cases that found that. So that's the perfect tender rule issue in this case. It's a defense by them to the otherwise clear conversion by them. They sold our property, and they still won't pay for it. If I could turn to some, just back to the statute of frauds argument, because there are some other arguments that Mr. Kotzker didn't address. They claim the merchant's exception is somehow sufficient to take this exclusive distribution agreement out of the statute of frauds. And it simply isn't. I want to address that. They seem to claim that Mr. Veen's email in November 2001 that says, we agreed to take the full factory output, is a writing and confirmation of a contract, and that Mr. Chong did not respond in 10 days and completely reject that. And that's simply not accurate. Mr. Veen's email wasn't even addressed to GITI China. It was addressed to a third party. Mr. Chong was only CC'd. So under the statute of frauds, our position is Mr. Chong could have just ignored that and no contract would have been created because there wasn't a email to him. But in any event, Mr. Chong did reply. He replied within 10 days, as required by the statute of frauds. And as I indicated before, he very clearly rejected what Mr. Veen was talking about. He said, please take note, there's an error. We will be selling to customers in Canada. You will not be getting everything in the USA and Canada. And that, of course, was sufficient to reject the notion that they would get the entire factory output. Because logically, if they're going to sell to people in Canada, that means they're not going to get the factory output. And then finally, it also didn't refer to the Primewell tire, which is at issue in this case, only the Kaiwan tire. They also claim that the partial performance exception to the statute of frauds can somehow take this contract out of it and salvage their claims. The district court properly found that that doesn't apply here. Ortec is not claiming that Trans-Pacific or GITI China failed to pay for or failed to deliver goods that it paid for or something of that nature. That's what the part performance exception is for. What they're claiming is a prospective, forward-looking, exclusive distribution agreement of indefinite nature. And the district court properly found that the part performance exception can apply to that. That's prospective. The fact that the parties had some other relationship, which we would submit in the record is clearly just a plain vanilla customer-supplier non-exclusive relationship, that doesn't serve to take the contract out of the statute of frauds. And even if that wasn't sufficient, Your Honors, to bar the claim about the exclusive distribution agreement, if the statute of frauds were somehow hypothetically satisfied, there are many alternative bases why that claim would have to fail, the biggest one of which we refer to in our brief, is that the evidence is undisputed that there was a failure to agree on essential terms for an exclusive distribution agreement of this type. Mr. Veen, Ortec's representative, concedes that there was no agreement on the specific duration of the alleged agreement. In his words, it could just go on forever no matter what happened. There was no agreement about the circumstances under which either party had the right to terminate. There was no agreement about the sales quotas or the performance standards that Ortec had to meet to keep the contract. There was no agreement with respect to prices or payment terms. This was simply too vague to be enforced under Maryland law. And we submit that this case is a perfect example of why this basic common law rule has to be in place. The contract Mr. Veen claimed to have was so vague that the only way for a court to enforce it and to make it commercially workable would have been to fill in all these terms for the parties, which is obviously improper under Maryland law.
And thus the appellant says detrimental reliance comes to the rescue.
Okay. Why don't I address that? That's exactly where I was going to go, Judge Davis. Thank you. Promissory estoppel, actually, they made a promissory estoppel claim with respect to the exclusive distribution agreement. Judge Chasnow properly found there was no promissory estoppel on that. They don't challenge that on appeal. Promissory estoppel is reserved for this Maryland warehouse agreement. The Maryland warehouse agreement where they say that my clients promised to pay certain expenses that they didn't pay, that they somehow induced Ortec to try to buy this warehouse. Judge Chasnow found, based on Mr. Veen's testimony that I referred to earlier, that there was no contract because there never was an agreement on essential terms. In fact, there was no agreement at all. He said we never had a final agreement. Terms were up in the air. It was still a work in process. On that basis, she found that there was no contract. On the same basis, Judge Chasnow followed a long list of cases in this court and others applying Maryland law that where there are not clear and definite terms of agreement, there can't be a clear and definite promise either. And it isn't reasonable for any businessman when he acknowledges in sworn deposition testimony that we had no final agreement, that terms were still being negotiated, to rely on that promise to his detriment. So for those two reasons, she found that there was no promissory estoppel. And the cases are legion on that point. I'd refer the court to the Estrin case versus Natural Answers in this court, where a distributor of herbs and vitamin products claimed that he had an exclusive contract, and the court went through all of the very many terms that were not agreed to there and said, our analysis with respect to the existence of a contract, the non-existence, applies with equal force to promissory estoppel. And obviously that has to be right. I mean, if a plaintiff admits, I knew there were still terms in the air. I knew we didn't have a final agreement. There can't be a clear and definite promise, and there can't be reasonable reliance. I'll speak briefly on the bond issue. Your Honors, we obviously contend it is moot at this point for exactly the reasons you said, Judge Davis. If you reverse and we're sent back to the district court, then the bond becomes a non-issue. If you affirm, then we have a final judgment. The one thing I would point out is that Mr. Kotzker suggests that the court should adopt the Fifth Circuit's test for whether or not to require a bond in the Poplar case. And in fact, that's exactly what Judge Chasnow did. She acknowledged the fact that there wasn't that kind of absolute guidance from this court, and she accepted his invitation to use the Poplar test, which requires the judgment debtor to objectively prove that the bond can either be satisfied by alternative means. All the cases we cite and then Mr. Kotzker cites are cases where there was no bond, but the defendant proved he had 87 times worth the value of the judgment in assets, or alternative assets were applied. Well, Mr. Kotzker's client never offered alternative assets. They just wanted to be relieved of the bond. And Judge Chasnow, under those circumstances, also found that he had not objectively proven an undue hardship simply by giving evidence of, I believe it was, unaudited tax returns and his own statements. That just wasn't sufficient. So regardless of whether the court accepts the invitation to apply Poplar as the law in this circuit, Judge Chasnow used it and found it wasn't met. And that's an abuse of discretion standard, Your Honors, and we submit there's no basis for upturning that appeal.
Your client hasn't sought execution so far?
Actually, we have, Your Honor. Yeah. That's another reason why it's moot, and I'll address that. ORTEC has not challenged the district court's judgment on counts 1 and 2. So there's $500,000 of judgment that they're not even challenging here. That's locked in. That's final. We have been attempting to collect. You know, the assets have been effectively hidden, but we haven't obtained $500,000 at this point. I'm sorry to say, we're still working on it. Unless the court has any other questions, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Farr. Very well. The matter is submitted. We appreciate counsel's presentations, and we'll come down and greet counsel and proceed immediately to the